Hey there, all you hip cats, cool kittens, you guys and dolls, you diesel-powered disciples of cool. This is the Diesel-Powered Podcast, the voice of Diesel Punk, the Diesel Punk Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. I am your host, the artist also known as Big Daddy Cool. You can call me Johnny, and joining me via the magic of the interwebs, once again, the gang is all here from Dallas-Fort Worth, from the boardroom, it's boss Larry Amiet.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
And from Memphis, the daring damsel of the skies, Daisy O'Dair.
Good evening, Sheiks and Shebas. How are you swinging tonight?
Solid on the 2-4. Can you dig that? I knew that you could. And, of course, joining us from the Eastern Seaboard, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Eric Fisk.
I think my studio finally thawed out.
Yeah? What's the weather like in your neck of the woods?
You know what? It is, it's right after we just had a, we just had Easter, obviously. I mean, we have Easter here just the same time everybody else does, but it was so nice having an Easter without any snow on the ground this year. That was like really nice. So,
go ahead.
By the way, do you know why we dye our eggs here in New England? So we can.
I don't. Why?
So we can find them in the snow after we've hidden them.
Well, you know, Eric, Larry and Daisy, they're true Southerners. They don't really understand this whole concept of snow on the ground at Easter time. I grew up in northeastern Ohio, and it was not uncommon at all for there to still be snow on the ground at Easter. So I know what you're talking about there, brother.
It's quite an experience. It's not something that it's really hard to explain to people unless they've actually experienced a white Easter. I think the worst Easter I can remember in recent memory was a couple of years ago where we were trying to go to our relative's house and it was coming down in ice and snow and sleet, and you had 2 feet of visibility. So of course we had to turn around, and gosh darn it, I had to go home and help the kids finish eating all of the jelly beans and chocolate. Darn.
Oh
yeah, it's a sacrifice. I know, it's I had to do the good thing as a dad. I had to do a good thing.
Well, so. And the flip side of that too is that our winter snow season started in October. How many times did you go trick-or-treating as a kid with a winter coat on?
All of them.
Yeah, exactly.
All of them. I don't understand this. What is this concept of not wearing your Skidoo suit under your costume? I don't understand. I don't understand this concept of how come your mom doesn't build your costume or around your coat and your ski pants and your long underwear and your heavy winter boots. I don't understand that.
Well, that was the magic of the Don Post Halloween costumes. You remember what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah,
get them at Kmart.
Yeah.
It's the plastic jumper kind of thing.
It was like a bib. It was like a bib with a picture or an image of something that you thought was cool and a face mask, and it was sort of like you were wearing a face mask and a billboard as a Halloween costume.
Yeah,
I had some of those.
But they were perfect to put over your winter coat and ski pants and the boots, because you get them, you know, size too big or whatever. You know, they one size fits all, whatever. And of course, those costumes never made it past the end of the night. But you know,
the rubber band always broke.
Well, I tried to take a shortcut through a thicket of bushes one time, the costume did not make it through the bushes with me.
I can't tell you how many times that has happened to us. So, but the thing,
the thing is
that I'm not saying that we are Jehovah's Witnesses, but my grandmother was a Jehovah's Witness, and my mother was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, and they didn't do Halloween. So she had this attitude where if I couldn't do Halloween when I was a kid, you can't do Halloween. Okay, I'll just take you to, I'll only take you to four houses, to the people that we know, and then that's it. And our costumes still, only after the fourth house, those costumes did not last. When we were always bummed out when they broke.
That is hysterical. Well, we could talk about Snowbound Halloween and Easter and Don Post costumes all night, but we are here to talk one thing and one thing only, and that is our love of diesel punk and all things diesel-y. And for those of you who are just tuning in, we forget about this, guys. We have new listeners every week. People who are doing a search for diesel punk, and you know, we talked about it the last time, more and more the search phrase deco punk is coming up. And if you've discovered us because you're looking for more diesel punk, well, welcome. And if you've discovered us by accident and you're wondering what are they talking about, what is diesel punk, well, Larry, why don't you tell our new listeners what this diesel punk thing is all about.
Well, thanks, Johnny. One of the most recent definitions I've seen that I really like, I got from my wife, and it's a mashup of modern ideas with jazz age sensibility. And I kind of like that. So if you think about the jazz age being 20s, 30s, 40s, give or take, and but filtered through a modern eye, a modern sensibility, modern concepts, then you have diesel punk.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I always love that idea of mashing up genres. And if you guys saw, did any of you guys see the pictures of me from MTAC over the weekend, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, or Murfreesboro?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
sure,
you look great.
Middle Tennessee, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
What does that stand for? Middle Tennessee Anime Convention. That's what it is, MTAC. So, you know, I got the awesome purple crocodile coat. And, you know, it's the Joker Suicide Squad coat, right? But, you know, you pair it with a fedora, waistcoat, and some two-tone wingtips, and it's definitely on the punk side of diesel.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You look great, though, man.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. So, you know, that's kind of the mashup stuff I like to do. And Larry, what are the three things that we kind of look for to make something diesel punk?
Well, one is the what we call decodance, which is a term coined inside the community, which meant just the spirit or the style of the 20s, 30s, 40s, something that gives you the feel of that era, maybe explicitly or maybe just at least the style, at least the feel of it. Also, contemporary, meaning that we, you know, there is some proto diesel punk, you know, King Kong, Metropolis, but we're talking about something that was made after the time. We're not co-opting productions of that era. And finally, there's punk, which is for us, which is the traditional classic meaning of the word, which is one that is a countercultural, outside the norm, maybe disreputable, so to speak. And those are the three main components you find. Anything that I would say is going to carry the label diesel punk needs to have all three of those components.
All right. And I like my diesel punk with a hefty spoonful of sci-fi and fantasy.
You know, well, sci-fi and fantasy, think about how little reputation it has in the establishment. You know, it's considered, it's not, you know, it's just now finally starting to get some degree of respectability. But when was the last time a sci-fi or fantasy won an Oscar?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, actually, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them just won an Oscar for outstanding achievement in costuming.
Yeah, they win that. I mean, Aliens won like Best Sound, something like that, when it came out. But by Oscar, I mean Best Picture.
Best Picture.
I mean, I get you.
I think that the one in the
I get you.
Sorry, guys. I don't mean to step over you. I think that
go ahead.
That for a lot of us, diesel punk sort of has to have. For me anyway, it has to have the punk element, as if it is like the anti-establishment against the current norms and a repudiation of everything that's modern, and trying to pull everything back to an era that sort of has the film noir at night, safari look during the day kind of aesthetic. And I think that that's the it's like sci-fi film noir is one way that a lot of people like to describe diesel punk. And it is. It's trying to just pull the aesthetic back to the way the future was back in the 30s and 40s. So, yeah. Boy, do I know how to kill a conversation.
Okay. See, hey, my son just popped his head in holding up two fingers, and I'm like, what?
Hey, that's an obscene sign in Europe. Better teach him otherwise.
Well, he was.
Well, which
he was
way were they facing?
They were facing him. You know, like he's holding up. You know, not the peace sign, but the reverse peace sign. And he was coming in to tell me that the Cavs Pacers game is now within 2 points. He's obsessed with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and they're in the playoffs. And, of course, you know, I grew up in northeastern Ohio, so they are kind of our family team. But, you know, am I one of the only people on the planet that really doesn't care anything about professional organized sports at all?
Oh, see, now you just rung my bell. Now it's like that's a Pavlovian response for me. Because the thing is that I've been dying to be able to talk about this on this podcast in particular. What drives me crazy is our fascination with spectator sports. And I have always been one of those people who, if I can't do it myself, I don't want to watch somebody else do it, because I want to watch. I would want to watch somebody do something that I would like to try someday. I don't know if anybody remembers on ABC television, The Wide World of Sports, where it wasn't football. Yeah. It wasn't football or baseball. It was the craziest athletic activities you could possibly imagine, and people doing it, like watching ski jumping or watching cross country skiing or the winter decathlon. That's something I would like to do someday. And there's a notion, especially here in New England, you are not a man if you don't go through the four seasons: Patriots, Celtics, Bruins, Red Sox. Those are the four seasons here in New England for a lot of sports fans, and sometimes those seasons overlap. But for me, I the one thing I love about football season is that all the nature trails and all the paths and the great outdoors is just left to me and my fellow hikers. I've never understood it, and if you permit me later on, I want to hear other people's thoughts about it. But there's another topic I got to get to, and that's NASCAR. Go ahead.
Oh Lord. Yeah, I know about NASCAR. Remember where I live.
So, I know. Yeah. I know.
The only sports I care about is if my alma mater's playing, so, you know.
but that's personal. I mean, I understand people's fascination with football or basketball if it's their high school team or their college team, because there's that connection. But, you know, the only thing that you have in common with your local team is that they're from the same area. The uniforms come from the same area that you come from.
You know what's ridiculous? You know what's weird about Memphis, though? Okay, we're in Tennessee, but I see absolutely no Tennessee Titans stuff. Everyone is supporting either the Pittsburgh Steelers or the Dallas Cowboys. And it's like, okay. All right.
Well, there's a reason for that, and it's because Memphis got snubbed for that team. But, you know,
oh, yeah.
You know, here's my thing about this. It's not that I don't like sports at all. To me, there's few things that are as fun as a day out at the baseball park. I love going to watch baseball. I love, the day at the park. You know, there's a lot of diesel era history involved with baseball, and
seeing it live is great.
You have to see the game live. You have to see the game live to really the greatest baseball games I've ever seen are ones that I've actually seen at the stadium. That's the best, and for me, that's the only way to see a baseball game.
But here's what I don't get, and I can't understand, and this is where I can't relate. These people who like act like they have some kind of vested ownership,
right,
in their team, you know, right. And they talk about, well, we're going to do this year, and we've got a great. I'm like, no, it's we nothing. They, you, I, last I checked, you're not suiting up and going out on the field. Where's this ownership? Anyway, yeah. I could talk about that all night.
Welcome to sports talk, all of us.
But you know, it kind of ties into the whole diesel punk attitude, right? What Eric was saying, kind of that push against, you know, common contemporary culture, and sports addiction is definitely a huge part of contemporary culture right now.
I think that as diesel punks, we have to take issue with car racing, and especially something like NASCAR, because the origins of NASCAR, the stock car racing, comes from bootlegging, comes from the Prohibition era, where people used to take cars off the lot, soup them up, and then drive deliveries, you know, across country roads, being chased by the police, maybe, maybe not. But the thing is that I'm fascinated with the notion of taking a car, any car, souping it up, and hitting the road with it. And one of the most fascinating things I've watched as far as spectator sports is the cross-country racing. And it's like, that's what I would like to be able to see more of, and see people get passionate about people who take a car, they soup it up, they do whatever they can with stock parts, and then hit the road with it, and whoever gets to cross the finish line first, across, I don't know, what, 100 miles? How long would it have to be? Whether it's out in the desert or out in the forest, wherever. And, you know, you have to drive through a river. You have to drive through uphills and downhills and through a valley and whatever. Mm-hmm. A little cross country.
That was an era. The diesel era was an age of some of that when that was pioneered.
Cross country
races.
I'm just saying, they ought to make like me. Next time, try flying.
Yeah.
Well, Eric, what you are describing is the Hanna-Barbera cartoon series, Wacky Races.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Which Dick Dastardly, one of the lead villains in that cartoon, has diesel punk written all over him.
And I don't think he was really the villain. I think he was misunderstood.
Most good villains are misunderstood.
Yeah.
Careful. Talk about it enough, we'll get a gritty reboot.
Maybe. Maybe.
Actually, there already has been. DC Comics.
Comic
series, Wacky Races. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, yeah. It's
well, it wasn't really Wacky Races based on the movie.
Well, then it's not wacky anymore. What do you call it, races?
Nah, it's Wacky Land Races. I don't know. But, yeah, Larry, you were just about to make the point that it is loosely based on the movie. It's a mad world, which is one of the funniest movies ever made.
And then there's Death Race 2000, which is another great classic. So it's so over the top. It's just it's so bad it's good.
Absolutely. All right. So moving right along, in search of good times and good news and good friends you can't lose, this could become a habit. Can anyone name that song or that movie? Anyone recognize those lyrics? If you're listening right now and you recognize the lyrics that I just quoted, put a comment on our Facebook page, and everyone who guesses correctly the correct song, the correct movie those lyrics came from, you will be entered for a drawing of my book, Tales from the Flip Side. We will draw randomly from all of the correct answers if you post that on our Facebook page.
Ooh, that what a prize.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, doing my part for our fans. Oh, yeah. Showing some love. So guys, did you guys see the big announcement I made this past Monday?
Yes, and I'm dying to be able to talk about that.
Well, let's talk about it. So first of all, the last time we were all together, I teased an interview that I did with Sarah Nethery, who is a well-known artist and steampunk cosplayer. And as you guys heard, if you listened to the interview, what prompted it was that she admitted that her true passion is diesel punk, and that she loves the era, she loves the time frame, she loves the costuming. That's where her heart really is. She's known for steampunk, but really steampunk is not her passion, her love. She kind of got into it to have something to do with her husband James Nethery, who you guys probably know from the series Steampunked, from the TV series. But they live here in Nashville, and I've become good friends with them. And when she announced that on her Facebook page very publicly, I was like, all right, I got to get her into the studio and have a sit down with her. So, you know, we started talking, and you know, she was a pinup model, and, you know, she was into the diesel aesthetic back in high school. You know, a very similar story to what we all have, right? Well, we go off the air, and we continue talking and, you know, just kind of getting to know each other. And turns out Sarah Nethery has a long-standing background in musical theater. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, you know, I danced and sang and did musical theater for years and years. And I'm like, well, why aren't you doing it now? And I don't remember her answer, but long story short, I planted a seed, and she sent me an audition video and blew me away. And about 5 hours later, I asked her if she would like to join my little band of Bombshell Kittens and perform on stage with us, and she responded ecstatically with a yes. And she will be making her onstage debut May 27th, which sounds like a long way off, but it's really just 4 weeks away, right around the corner, here in Nashville at the Centennial Black Box Theater. And I'm super excited about this. Guys, Sarah Nethery, not only is it kind of a game changer for me in that, you know, she's kind of a celebrity, a pseudo celebrity in the genre punk community. And but more than that, she is a phenomenal talent. And I can't wait personally until I've got Sarah and Daisy both on stage together.
What, little old me?
Yes. Daisy, I love performing with you, and our audiences always love it when you get to do gigs with us. It's just, you know, they're kind of far and few between because you're there, I'm here, and, you know, we don't always get to meet up like we'd like to. But, you know, anyway, this is a real game changer for the ensemble, and I'm really, really excited and super stoked about Sarah. And you guys, I would never have thought this. I'm really bad about, believe it or not, I have a pretty severe case of low esteem. And it always amazes me that anyone wants to be involved in anything that I'm doing to begin with. But not only did she want to be involved, she like approached me and, you know, was proactive. And, you know, we're talking every day about, you know, ideas and what she's, you know, wanting to do and how excited she is. And just it's been great. It's been great. And I can't wait for the rest of the world to see her on stage with Big Daddy Cool.
I think that that's some of the best news that I've heard in the entertainment industry in weeks. I'm excited, and the thing is that I hope you guys cut an album or CD or whatever the kids are calling it these days. You know, get some tunes going, and I want to see and hear it all.
Well, you know, an album has been on my radar for literally, Eric, about 15 years. The last studio session I did, I used to sing in a gospel group called Hand of Mercy, and we did a studio album about 15 years ago, and had some success, some moderate success, and, you know, I still sing professionally, and I'm going to be doing a concert this weekend up in Richmond, Kentucky at my alma mater at Eastern Kentucky University. But, you know, for whatever reason, having vocalists, other caliber co-star vocalists has been a little bit of a challenge. And Sarah has come on, and there's two other singers that are part of the group now, and we're working on group ensemble stuff. We're going to be working this Monday on an arrangement of Route 66, and just got a lot of cool stuff in the hopper. So an album may be on its way.
Well, Johnny, of course,
yes,
I got to let you know. You got to call me if you're ever doing that album thing, because I am sitting on a few original tunes that are half-baked myself.
Well, come on. Get up here to Nashville.
We'll make that's happen. That's where all the music happens.
Well, yeah, we're probably going to do, I'm thinking we're going to do a live album. You know, record it live on stage. So, you know what? You and me, we'll keep talking. And we'll make that happen. Yeah. So, anyway, that's my big news, and something I'm really excited about. And, you know, for the diesel punk community as at large, you know, I think it... I think Sarah's influence, you know, because she is kind of a pseudo celebrity. She would never admit that, and her husband James, they're very humble. They hate it when, you know, I kind of call them that. But, you know, everybody in the retro punk communities know who they are. And so I think it can be a really big boon for diesel punk in general to have, you know, someone of that high profile, you know, coming over and saying, this is who I am and this is what I love.
I think that's huge. I mean, it was huge watching it. It was huge watching her admit this, and it was I think it was a big, huge win for diesel punks, and I'd like to feel bad for steampunks, but I really can't. I mean, I'm glad that she's on our team. I'm glad that she's on our side. I mean, sorry guys. I mean, I don't know what the, she'll probably still do steampunk occasionally, but no, I think that it was just like I think that that's what a lot of us feel. We sort of like gravitated towards steampunk for a while because it seemed like that was the only game in town. And, you know, and for a lot of us who have been retrocentrics and retronauts, you know, since we were, you know, teens raiding the Army Navy surplus stores for items, and we were diesel punks before diesel punks, and we just got on the steampunk thing just for a while because that's where it seems like that's where it was at. And to have somebody like Sarah come out and say, hey, I'm really more of a diesel punk, I think that was huge. It was exciting watching the conversation between the two of you. So
we had a lot of fun. Go ahead.
I'm just glad that I was able to contribute a couple of really good questions, and I enjoyed her answers. I think that, and the thing is that, I mean, she is literally a femme fatale in the sense she's beautiful and she's smart, and just like my wife, she's one of those women that you would do anything for. And I'm telling you, they're dangerous. They know how to get you. And she seems genuine. She seems like a genuine person that you could have a conversation with, and you know she's not shallow, or she's not superficial. She's not like the stereotypical supermodel. She's a decent human being, and inside and out. And I think that she's a big win for us. But
Yeah, and that all of that is absolutely true. And here's the kind of the second part of that. She had so much fun being on the air. She wants to do it more often.
Ooh, all right.
Well, yeah, she's
fantastic. I think we need another member on the show.
Well, we'll see what happens there. You know, we may be adding more video, doing that again. We had over 3,000 people watch that video. The audio segment that we recorded for this podcast ended up being our highest rated single episode for, you know, the first week of release that we've had. Because, again, people know who she is. They tuned in just to see and hear her. And so, yeah, we're definitely going to be doing more stuff with her on air and with this podcast. And, you know, she'll be appearing with me as one of the Bombshell Kittens, you know, as a performance partner. And for those of you who don't know, really, you know, the Bombshell Kittens are not just, you know, tag-alongs or you know, assistants, as Daisy can attest. She's one of the family. They are true performance partners, and they get to, you know, they share the spotlight. They are not in the background or supporting players in any way, shape, or form. So
you've got a whole big sack of talent there on that stage.
Well, you know, I like to say that I know how to pick them. And yeah, well, you know, everybody always says to me, they're like, you know, they'll introduce me and they'll say, Johnny's so talented, or they'll say, Johnny, you have so many talents. And really, the truth is, I'm not talented at all. I fake it really well.
You're talented at finding talent.
Well, that is my true talent. My true talent is seeing the untapped potential in people and bringing it out of them. So anyway, enough about that. One of the things I wanted to talk about tonight, guys, is the last time we talked, I had mentioned that I finally got Amazon Prime, and I had the opportunity after finishing Iron Fist on Netflix, which, by the way, I loved, and I'm just going to say that the criticism of it is totally unfounded, and we'll leave that for another conversation. But I finally got to sit down and watch season one of Man in the High Castle, and I've just started season two, and I got to tell you, this show is by hands down one of the best television programs I've ever watched.
Now that, I'm not surprised you said that, Johnny. Well, I'm not surprised. I knew you were going to love it.
I knew I was going to love it too. I couldn't justify spending the money for Amazon Prime just for one series. Now I'm glad that, you know, we have it. You know, we're using it for shipping and whatnot, but the perk of having this awesome series at my fingertips is just phenomenal. Well, Eric, you were going to add?
Well, the thing is that one of the things I want to ask you, and it's a question somebody else asked me in reference to Man in the High Castle. Do you love it because it is such a great show, or do you just like it because it's Diesel Punk and you look past some of the problems with the show? My answer to that is, what problems with the show? I'm not at all convinced that there's anything wrong with the show. I think the show is a flawless show. It's a retro futuristic version of Mad Men, and I loved Mad Men. And it really tackles a lot of the questions that a lot of other authors have asked, as far as what would have happened if the Nazis had won. I think that's a very powerful and scary question. It's a flawless show, because the thing is that it's like, you know, it's a flawless show. Whereas at the end of every episode, you're caught between, do you want to just digest what you just watched, or are you just dying to get through the next episode? Like, you got to see the next episode to see how it ends, or do you want to savor every one of them? It's that kind of show.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, I was really tempted to binge watch it. I've sworn off binge watching after Luke Cage on Netflix. Because I love Luke Cage, and I watched it. I spent, 14 hours straight watching that show. And at the end of it, I felt kind of empty inside, because it was all of a sudden it was over. And yes, I didn't have anything left to look forward to. So with this show, I'm not doing that. I'm watching an episode here or there. It took me 2 weeks to get through season one, watching one or two episodes a night. And not every night, you know, some nights, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing now. But I do think, Eric, that it is a perfect show. I don't think there are any problems with it at all, unless you consider this a problem. When I watch this show, and keep in mind, I've only finished season one, I'm first episode into season two, I felt a little disturbed in that I ended up liking the bad guy.
John, Abengoober Fuhrer, John Smith.
Yes.
But Johnny, isn't that the genius of this show, is that it doesn't paint there's no Snidely Whiplash in this show. You know, the characters are they're well-rounded. That's how people are.
It struck me how it was very profound when you think about that. the America that they are living in the what is it, 68 or 62
when it's
the
early series 60s, takes place. Early 60s.
62. Yeah, but the America that they're living in really is not different from what it really was, mm-hmm. or how it is today. The differences in that America and our America today, I mean, there are some, but for the most part, the people went on about their lives and, you know, focused on what mattered to them, you know, making a living, taking care of their families, you know, obeying the law, not being troublemakers, which I mean, that sounds kind of like, you know, being whipped into submission, but I mean, that's really kind of how we are today, right? Nobody really wants to cause a ruckus or be a problem, but, you know, people just want to make a living and have a good life and have friends and family that they love. And that's what made John Smith so relatable, is because that is who he is. He is just a family man who is, you know, making his way in the world, making a living, doing the best he can by his family. And man, first of all, Rufus Sewell is one of my all-time favorite actors.
Oh, yeah.
He's
fantastic.
Yeah, he was phenomenal in everything else that I've seen him in. And he was also in another one of my favorites that I think that we've already talked about. But go on, John.
Yeah. And he brings this perfect blend of contemptibility and ultimate likability all within the same few moments.
Oh, yeah.
Because there are moments in this show where I'm just like, oh, would someone just punch him in the face? Mm-hmm. But then there are moments when he's faced with the reality that he, and this is a spoiler alert for everyone listening, when he is faced with the reality that he is going to have to put his own son to death, mm-hmm. because he's got a disease that is going to handicap him in this brave new world. You know, those people, that's what the Nazis did. They got rid of the weak and, mm-hmm. You know, the infirmed. And, you know, you really feel for him because you see it on his face. He really weighs the weight of this looming predicament.
But now let me play a little devil's advocate here on something.
Yeah.
Would he have felt the same weight and burden if it had not been his own son?
Not at all.
No, he would have been calling the Senate, whatever police out, and he would have been the first one having the kid dragged off, and if the kid wouldn't go willingly, he'd probably shoot him right there and say, oh, well, time for lunch.
Yeah.
So, you wouldn't want to turn your back on John Smith.
You really, which is why, before you say anything else about John Smith, I think that you're talking about a version of John Smith that Larry and I don't even recognize anymore, I don't think, after watching season two. And I mean that in
season two.
You have to, your thoughts and feelings and how you see John Smith is really going to mature and is really going to take you by surprise without spoiling anything for you, John. And I really want to be able to just blurt something out, but I'm not going to say it. You have to see season two all the way to the end. And when you see how John Smith's family situation evolves over the next, 12 or 13 episodes, it's like you love him and you hate him for deeper reasons. Your thoughts and feelings about John Smith have not fully matured yet because you've not seen season two yet. And it was just like, God, I just want to spoil it for you, but I can't.
Yeah, the writing is just amazing. And, you know, my thought was what Eric was saying was, you know, how can they keep this up? How can they keep the quality going? Oh, my goodness, are they going to jump the shark? And no, it continues, the characters evolve. John Smith evolves, but at the end, he's still John Smith, but he grows. And by the time you're done at the end, it's like, trust us, John, you're going to enjoy it, season two.
Well, I'm going to definitely see it. And I just was doing I pulled up the cast list before we went on so that I wouldn't mess up anybody's names. And they have announced season three is on its way. So
obviously.
Yay.
Obviously.
And I guess there's something in the final episode that says there has to be a season three.
Yes. Yes. And
now,
go ahead, John.
Go ahead. No,
well,
go ahead.
Well, okay. You go ahead. So the thing is that, and this is for everybody who's been huge fans of Man in the High Castle. And after watching the Man in the High Castle, you're going to very much want to keep it going and understand it, or look at other people's perspective on what could have happened. And there are two books that I've read in the past month that I have to share with everybody here. The first one is a novel from Sinclair Lewis. It's called It Can't Happen Here. And
oh, yeah.
It's a book about how it can happen here. And what's surprising for me is that some of the locations in this book are places where I've lived, or it's not too far from where I live here. It's about the perspective of the rise of fascism here in the United States that parallels Nazi Germany. And the second half of the book is about the resistance against fascism here, and America kind of going into a guerrilla war with Canada and Canadians and Americans who are not going to go along with the program. And it's very easy to see how so many people that we know and love could fall into that trap. Whereas, you know what? Try a little fascism. You might like it. Wouldn't you want to have a place where everybody has a job and everybody has a purpose and the trains always run on time? Wouldn't you enjoy a world like that? Try new and improved fascism. And it's told in the
Shiny new name.
Of the shiny, yes, exactly. Try fascism in the new box. And it's presented in such a, in the way this story is told, it's told through audio clips and conversations that people have. It's as if you're watching, reading, or listening to somebody's scrapbook of these events, and it's very captivating. Once you get the rhythm of the book, it goes by very fast. But it can't happen. Well, go ahead, Daisy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say I got a little trivia about that book.
Go ahead.
Back in the early 1980s, there were some people who were trying to make a miniseries out of that book. And they were pitching it to the major networks, but nobody wanted to touch a story about Nazis. So you know what they did?
No. What did they do?
They turned them into aliens, and that's how we got V.
Really? No kidding.
Really, the seed of the V miniseries was the book, was someone trying to make a miniseries out of It Can't Happen Here.
And that's fascinating, because there's a lot of parallels between the Nazis and the aliens in V.
One of the best TV miniseries of all time.
Absolutely, and it's very dated. But in another,
what was the
what? Let's go ahead, John.
Yeah, what was the other book?
The other book is it's the perfect combination between Angela's Ashes and Man in the High Castle. It's the plot against America, and it's through the book is written by Philip Roth through the eyes of Philip Roth in an alternate reality as a child, if Charles Lindbergh, the Nazi sympathizer, was able to run against Roosevelt and win and become an ally or a neutral party in World War II and align ourselves with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And how would that go about? With a charismatic character and a national hero, Charles Lindbergh, as, you know, I mean, Lucky Lindy, the man who crossed the Atlantic Ocean, and the man who had very strong Nazi sympathetic feelings or thoughts. And he was open. He thought, hey, listen, Adolf Hitler is doing a great job turning around the economy of Jupiter. Not Jupiter, Germany. The economy of Jupiter. Yeah. So, you can tell I've had a long day already. So the thing is, it's through the eyes of a child seeing, as a Jew living in New York and seeing how people are subjugated and how people lose their rights. People are willing to give up the rights of other for a sense of security in themselves. Being able to ship Jews off to different parts of the country and stuff like that. And how it could happen here. And it's like, once you get done with Man in the High Castle, you're going to want to pick up these books. And you want to keep going with all of this. Like, what would it be like for you to be in a situation like Man in the High Castle?
Well, one of the other things that I loved about this series is, one, the character of Trade Minister Tagawa.
Yes. Yes.
Tagomi.
Tagomi.
Played by Kerry Hiroyuki Tagawa. Easy for you to say. Another one of my favorite actors. He's one of those guys that every time you see him, you're like, oh, I love that guy in that movie or this movie. In The Shadow, he was the great Cab I Sang. In The Phantom, rather, not The Shadow. You know, he's got a lot of Diesel Punk credits to his name. Great guy. But the character that frustrated me the most and that I just couldn't figure out, and I kept asking myself, dude, what are you doing, is the character of Joe Blake.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Joe does the dumbest stuff. And I get it. You know, we're supposed to sympathize with his plight. You know, here he is, an undercover Nazi agent trying to bring down the resistance, and he gets caught in the trap of having feelings for Juliana. But at the same time, I'm like, Joe, you're making dumb mistakes. Where is your head? And, you know, I kind of found myself in the position of John Smith, looking at him, just scratching my head, going, what is your problem, dude?
Well, I think Joe's issue is he's conflicted. He has this idealized, and because look at his age. He's pretty much been raised, on the Nazis, and he's kind of got this idealized. And then at times, though, he sees what they are, and then he has a conscience that's just eating at him. You know, maybe this ain't right, but. It's almost like a cult, and Nazis were like a cult, and he's kind of struggling, wanting to break away out of the cult, that he gets sucked right back into it. I think that's what you're seeing a lot of, John, in his character, is he's fighting this cult-like attraction that he has with the Nazis. That's my take on Joe.
And again, you gotta watch season two, because...
Yeah,
what happens to Joe Blake in season two is another emotional roller coaster, and you see how bad can it get for Joe Blake? Well, you're going to find out. Joe Blake goes through perhaps maybe the scariest of all journeys in season two. And the thing is that you look at what Joe Blake goes through, and you have to ask yourself, what would you do if you were in that situation? What would you do if you were in that position? And really ask yourself, Larry and I know, like, what position that he is put in. And he's probably put in one of the worst possible positions you can possibly imagine. And he's also, it's one of the greatest temptations you could possibly imagine. And, wow, gee, wouldn't you go along with this too? It's scary, because the thing is, you could look at Joe Blake, who is a screw-up, and you can't help but wonder, if I was in that position, do you think that I would be making the same mistakes as well? I don't know.
Sure, and, you know, that's a good point, Eric. In fact, and at the risk of a spoiler, if you think they're screwing with his brain in season one, yo, that poor guy, you really start to feel for Joe in season two. You really start to feel for him.
Well, I will get there sooner than later, so I'm really super excited about it. And anyone listening, if you're looking for great, great diesel punk entertainment, this is it. And look, it's not just diesel punk because it's alternative history. It's diesel punk because there is some science fiction and fantasy woven in here too. And you guys know what I'm talking about, of course. Dealing with the films and the origin and the source of the films. And, of course, I think Trade Minister, the Japanese Trade Minister, Togomi, gets a first-hand seat into a viewing of that. And I'm sure that expands further in season two.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I cannot begin to tell you some of the things that we experience, whereas all you can say is that the trade minister definitely steps into the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and the last thought I had is I'd left the final episode of season one. I left it thinking that the man in the high castle was not at all who everyone else thought it was. Now, season two came along and put that theory in doubt. But there's still some clues being dropped that the man in the high castle that the resistance is working for is someone other than who we think it is. Does that make sense to you guys?
No, it makes perfect sense. As somebody who has seen season two, I can tell you one of the best things about this series, especially these two seasons so far that we've seen, is that the identity from the man in the high castle is still left up in the air. At the end of season two, you still don't know who the man in the high castle. You don't know who is the source of these films. If you haven't seen the series, the whole thing is about where are these films coming from alternate timelines. The films that these people are passing around and smuggling and trying to steal and steal back. All these films come from alternate dimensions, same place and time, but you see other alternate histories, and it's every season seems to revolve around one or two rules of film, and as you see the show progress, you see some things where it's just like you're sort of like, How would you feel if you could see the role you were playing in an alternate dimension, an alternate timeline? How would that make you feel? How would it make you feel if you could see a version of yourself in a different circumstance? like in another alternate dimension, is there a Dr. Eric Fisk somewhere who's working in an ER? In an alternate dimension, is there a homeless bum, Eric Fisk, a drug addict living in a crack house? In an alternate dimension, is there another Eric Fisk who's a soldier and fighting against alien invaders or something like that? How would that make me feel? How would that change the way that I look at my life? And how would it change all the other Eric Fisks and the other parallel dimensions if they knew about me? And that's the entire thing about Philip K. Dick, is that he gets you to question not just the fabric of reality, but the fabric of your own reality. How would you feel if you woke up tomorrow morning and you found out that you were an android and all your memories were implanted in the factory, like in Blade Runner? And that's what Philip K. Dick does. He's able to get you to screw. He gets to screw with your head by you doing most of the heavy lifting.
Speaking of Philip K. Dick and androids with implanted memories, kind of changing topics, watch Man in the High Castle if you haven't seen it yet. Make the investment into Amazon Prime. Watch it, love it, live it. It's fantastic. But shifting gears, you know, we've got this summer the sequel to Blade Runner coming out. And nobody is enthusiastic about this movie at all. I was at a screening of, I forget what movie it was, the trailer showed. And, you know, I like to watch people's reactions during trailers. And nobody cared, which is something that I was afraid of from the very beginning when I heard it was going to be announced. But I think this sequel is a big mistake for a couple of reasons. But the main reason is, you know, the original Blade Runner left us all with a question. A hanging chad, if you will. Was Decker, he himself, a replicant, right?
Yes.
There were clues that kind of steered you that way, but never concretely gave you the answer. It was left up to you to decide in your own mind. Well, this sequel picks up, what, 30 years later, and Decker's still around, and he's coaching the new Blade Runner, played by Ryan Gosling. And to me, that fact alone, and it's played by Harrison Ford, that fact alone completely ruins the mystique of the original movie.
Why can't they just leave things alone?
That's a great question, Daisy. I think just Hollywood has just, they've run dry on creativity. So it's just regurgitating and sequels and reboots. What we're coming into the third Spider-Man reboot.
Yeah.
Might be great. Hope it is. But really, do we need a third Spider-Man reboot? But no, that's a great question, Daisy. I mean, it's like, leave well enough alone. That is a movie, I think, Blade Runner. You're right, Johnny. There's all these unanswered questions at the end. You know, were they chased after they left the apartment? You know, did somebody follow, you know, another Blade Runner? What happened when they went north? You know, those are great questions, and let them hang. That's part of the mystique, part of the fun. Because everybody has their own answers and ideas. And yeah, I'm not optimistic about the new movie. And I hate that.
Well,
I'm not optimistic.
Here's just out of curiosity, Larry, are you a Star Trek fan at all?
Rabid Star Trek fan.
What do you think about the J.J. Abrams reboot of Star Trek?
Okay.
That's my point.
I watched it. I went to this theater, saw it twice at the theater. I'm a geek. And I own a copy of it. It's okay. If it comes on cable, I'll watch it. But it's not, but then again, if I have a choice between it and any of the spinoffs, and that includes Enterprise, I'll watch those before I watch into J.J. Abrams stuff. Okay. I haven't seen the third movie. I'm not really that fired up about it.
I got to say the third one is the best of the three.
Yes.
Really? It is.
It really is.
I agree.
Yeah. But the thing,
crew is a family.
Yeah, but the thing is that for me, getting back to the entire issue of Hollywood running out of ideas and they're just recycling and they're just rebooting all these great franchises, all they had to do, come up with your own universe, come up with your own, what would life look like 400, 500 years in the future when humanity becomes a space-faring race, and deal with that. Come up with your own idea of a spaceship. Come up with your own idea of Council of Planets or whatever it is. Do what J. Michael Straczynski did with Babylon 5. You start your own thing.
Okay. The thing about that is, people have tried to start their own things and audiences didn't really get into it. They didn't respond to it. So they just keep recycling all this stuff because what people want to see is what they're familiar with.
And I think that's sad.
That's a good point, too.
I think that's sad. And I think that that's a horrible condemnation, and it's a true condemnation, about American audiences. Whereas it's like we're lazy. Not me. I would love to be able to see something new and fresh that is not a reboot of Lost in Space, Star Wars, Twilight Zone, Star Trek, or anything like that. I would rather see something new. Like, you look at The Expanse. You look at The Expanse, and that's something that somebody else has started, like, all over again. Or something started from fresh, and it's an incredible show.
And it does seem to be that anything really new, the fans love it, but it doesn't last. I saw a few episodes of Firefly. It was okay, but man, it has a rabid, rabid base. And it was a very different sci-fi space opera.
Yeah.
Well, and I thought
it lasted a season, and they've never brought it back, no matter how many people screamed for it. They would probably but I think I'm just throwing that out there as an example. Battlestar Galactica was reimagined into one of the greatest space operas in television history. Reimagined Battlestar. And I guess that kind of goes against what I was saying earlier about the Star Trek reboot. So, anyway.
Well, so let me share this with you guys. This is one of my favorite stories, and it's a true story. Living here in Nashville, there's all manner of interesting characters and personalities, and of course, the country music industry is rich with history. And I have a friend whose father owned one of the most successful restaurants in Nashville history, a place called Nero's Cactus Grill. And back in the 60s and 70s, it was the place to be. Piano bar, huge thick steaks, celebrities. It was a swank place. Well, so this kid comes in, this singer-songwriter who's trying to make his way in the Nashville music scene. There's an ad for a piano player. They needed a new piano player. So this kid walks in, auditions for the piano gig, plays a couple of tunes for Nero, and that was his name, Nero. And Nero doesn't really know anything about music, but he's watching some of the people in the restaurant and looking at their faces while this kid's playing. And he decides, okay, I don't know if you're good or not, but these people like you got the gig. You know, you start tonight. So he comes in, sits down at the piano, and he starts playing. And he starts playing some of his original music. And Nero comes over. And if you saw the movie La La Land,
mm-hmm.
very similar story. I think the La La Land may actually be based off this real account. The manager comes over to him and says, hey, what are you playing? I don't pay you to play your original stuff. People want to hear the songs they know. You know, play the stuff that they know. And so, you know, he plays a couple more of the old favorites. People are putting tips in his jar, and he decides to play another original. And finally, Nero comes over and he says, hey, kid, look, if you can't play the songs I need you to play, I you can't do this gig. And he said, you can keep the tips from tonight. I'll pay you, but you don't need to come back tomorrow. And so he packs up at the end of the night, takes his tips, and he leaves Nero's, never to go back. A year later, this kid writes a song, and Janis Joplin records Me and Bobby McGee. And
oh, wow.
Kris Kristofferson becomes a household name in music. And he would later talk about this event. And he said, the night I was fired from Nero's was the night that set my career on its true path. He said, entertainers play the same old songs that everybody wants to hear. But an artist plays the songs that people didn't know they needed to hear, but can't live without them after they've heard them. And that is where Hollywood is, right? Hollywood just right now, they're pumping out the same old songs that everyone knows and loves. But then something comes along like Kubo and the Two Strings, that is one of the most phenomenal, visually stunning, compelling movies ever made. And if you've not seen it, you need to see it. Like, tonight, it's on Netflix. Or along comes a TV series like Man in the High Castle, adapted from the source material, but something completely different from anything else that is out there. And audiences will respond to quality. And I think that's the lesson that Kris Kristofferson has for us, is that if you produce original work that is quality and that you're passionate about, there is always an audience for it. There is always someone who will consume it and be a fan. And you have to decide whether you're going to be just another one of the entertainers or whether you're going to be an artist. And I think what we kind of exemplify in the Diesel Punk community is a love for the artist. Because isn't really that part of our entire credo and philosophy? To not just sing the same old songs that everybody's singing, but to find something that you didn't know you wanted or that you didn't know you were going to like, and then afterwards you can't live without it. Anyway, that's my two cents about Hollywood and the entertainment industry tonight.
And I think that that's, for me, that's the perfect place where we should leave it tonight, because I don't think anybody can top that tonight.
Nope. You're about right over there.
Well said, Johnny.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate the vote of confidence, and we will end it there. It is getting late. Of course, all of you listening, we love you guys as an audience. We couldn't do it without you. And want to encourage you, if you do like the songs that we're singing, tell two or three more of your friends to tune in, listen to the Diesel Powered Podcast. We are the Diesel Punk Podcast. And that's a little bit of foreshadowing, by the way. Well, I might as well spill the beans. As we leave, I'll spill the beans. We are going to be going through a slight name change on the podcast.
Oh.
And it really stems from the fact that I want more people to find us. We are the Diesel Punk Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Why not use that as the title? And so after tonight's episode, we are a diesel powered podcast, but we will be the Diesel Punk Podcast. Yes.
Woohoo.
That's awesome.
And there was a kind of a secondary motivation for that, and that is there's a trucking company that has a very they have a podcast that they started that has exploded that is also called the Diesel Powered Podcast. It's Ooh. About trucks and big rigs. And you know what? Let's not confuse our audience.
Yes, please.
So let's just be direct and upfront and be who we are. And we are the Diesel Punk Podcast. And going forward, that is that's going to be our new show title, our new network title. So not a huge change, but I think a good one, a positive one, and it will help more people find us. And if you're listening to us right now, tell your friends, tell your family to tune in and get hep to the jive we're laying down and the smooth groove we're singing. And that would be awesome, awesome fun. Connect with us online, facebook.com/dieselpoweredpodcast, soon Diesel Punk Podcast. Follow us on at the website, and the new web address will be thedieselpunkpodcast.com, but the old URL, the Diesel Powered Podcast, is not going away. None of that titling and branding is going away. So, you know, our old fans will still be able to find us. It's not going to be, you know, a big, super big change right away. It'll be a gradual change, but it'll be a positive change. So anyway, connect with us online, shoot us a Facebook message, follow us on Twitter, Diesel Podcast, and that would be great. Larry, any last thoughts before we sign out?
Well, no. I do want to promote a movie. Anybody that hasn't seen Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, you've got to see this movie. I recently got my copy on Blu-ray, and that's pure diesel pump. That is good stuff. So I do highly recommend it. But I tell you what, folks, weather's turning nice, and it's getting comfy outside. But, you know, don't forget about your neighbor still, okay? Still, you know, check on them. Weather might be nice, but check on your neighbor. Say hi. You know, walk next door, knock on the door, see how they're doing. Take care of each other, because that's what life is all about.
That always makes me smile to hear you say that, Larry.
Appreciate it. Daisy,
any last thoughts?
Well, I just want to say, Diesel Powered or Diesel Punk, we'll always be your sweethearts. So, good evening, friends.
Excellent. Eric?
I would like to remind everybody, especially this week, check out one of my other podcasts. It ties into what we talked about tonight. Professor Walt Schnabel and I talk about a document that was done by the Brookings Institute that between 1958 and 1960, they wrote a document that predicted the future. And it's a future that we are literally living today. It's an amazing story. So just check it out at themetaphysicalpodcast.com. And on top of that, I want to encourage you people to go out and read. Read your history. Go look. I'm not getting a plug for this at all. Go to Audible and look up books on World War II history, especially World War II spies. I'm going to publish my wish list, books that I've listened to and I am listening to. You're missing out on so much awesome history. It's not even funny. So, but anyway, until the next time I talk to you guys, remember to keep your chins up and your fedoras on. And like Larry says, be good to each other.
Outstanding. And I'll close this out just by reminding you guys to swing hard, swing often. And until the next time, we'll catch you on the flip side.